The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. We're not brushing long enough, or we forget to change our brush on time. And that's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different? Well, for starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of the bulkier brushes. Plus, my favorite feature, they have a built-in timer that helps you clean for the 2 minutes that dentists recommend you brush your teeth for. And Quip has a great subscription plan where they will deliver new brush heads to you every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O list, named one of Time's best inventions, and it is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/nerd right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/nerd, spelled GETQUIP.com/nerd. What do I love about teaching my Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives? Well, I like to take a group of improvisers, complete strangers, people that don't know each other from all over the world. And they come together in a very short period of time. They build support and trust and vulnerability, the stuff that makes great improv teams and great improv groups. We get them to play like they've been playing together for years. Over the weekend, you'll learn things like, before you can be funny, you need to be real, which means focus on being believable first. Also, going one line at a time, responding off the last thing your partner has said. And of course, slowing down, because improvisers today are missing great stuff, gold that's right in front of them. All they need to do is shut their mouth and look at their partner. It's that easy. So if you're already coming into Chicago this summer, why not take the opportunity and study with me and improvisers from all over the world, learning my unique, slow comedy approach to improv that makes it as easy as having a conversation. I'll be teaching these summer weekend intensives the weekend of July 14th and 15th, July 28th and 29th, and August 11th through the 12th. To register or for more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. See you this summer.
Jimmy, Jimmy Corain, Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Mark Chosky. He's one of Chicago's most respected improvisers, actors, and teachers. He teaches at the Second City Training Center here in Chicago, and he's performed in Flanagan's Wake at the Improv Institute, and he is definitely old school, and that's what I love about. We talk to him about what he stresses in his classes, hard truth and realism. He gives us a good example and an exercise to demonstrate this. Also, how he develops his wonderful characters on stage, and how he went from being a mess to getting his life in order, and meditation is one of the things that has helped him to be more in the moment. Before we get to the interview with Mark, last weekend was my birthday. Thank you very much. I turned 54 years old, and when I got up, I had all this special stuff that I had planned, and I was really looking forward to it. Today was my day to celebrate my birthday and, you know, go to the bookstore and go to the health club and hang out with friends. But when I got up, Lauren's been sick, and she really was sick. So we're like, okay, we got to take you to the immediate care, which is like the emergency room light is basically what it is. And we went there, and when you have a child, it's a little more difficult. So we all drove to the immediate care, And then I dropped Lauren off, and then I took Betsy to a mall where they had a park, and we played, and then we came and picked up Lauren, and she got some, she didn't get some great advice. Can you believe that? She didn't get great medical advice. They thought it was an allergy, and it turned out it was a virus, because Monday she went for a second opinion. So all of Saturday, I pretty much, you know, took care of Betsy and took care of Lauren, and I got to tell you something, I couldn't have been a better birthday. And I don't know what this is about me, and well, I am pretty screwed up, you know this, but anytime Lauren, not anytime, but when Lauren gets sick, I do enjoy taking care of her. And I remember the first time we went on a vacation, we were just dating, and we went to see her parents. They always stay in Marco Island, and we were in a hotel, and Lauren got food poisoning. We all had the same fish sandwich, but she had different tartar sauce than we did, and so she got food poisoning. And I still look back at that as one of my favorite trips of all time. She was sick for a while, and she slowly got better, but I don't know what it is that I really enjoy taking care of my wife. Then there's a point where I get resentful and angry about it, but on a trip or on my birthday, it was very nice. All right, enough about my ramblings. You're going to love this episode. It's got so much stuff here. Mark is such a great teacher. Mark is such a great improviser. He's one of the people that I love improvising it when John Hildreth and I do Jimmy and Johnny. Here it is, the Mark Chosky episode. Enjoy. Mark Chosky, welcome for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, growing up, you described yourself as a class smartass and not the class clown.
Right.
Can you tell me the difference?
Well, in grammar school and high school, there were definitely a few kids that were definitely funnier than me. So.
Well, so how did you, like, so the smartass, what does the smartass do?
Even back at that young age, I guess I was looking at life satirically, you know, and commenting on it, commenting on teachers, commenting on the system we were in, commenting on the Catholic religion, going to church, you know, every Sunday, whatever, in a satiric way. And that would get me in trouble with the, you know, teachers.
And what kind of trouble did you get into?
Okay. I'll give you a perfect example. In seventh grade, and Miss Klutz, her name for real, she was our teacher, and there was another teacher, Mr. Brusky, the science teacher, and he had a crush on her, I guess, you know. So he would find reasons to come in class and do something silly and leave and come in. So we were having one class, don't remember what it was, English, whatever, and he had done it a few times. And then he opened the door and sent a little mechanical car in, and it went into her desk, you know. And, you know, and when he came in for like the fourth or fifth time, I was fed up with it for some reason. It's like, you know, I want to have class. So as he's leaving, under my breath, I say, "See you around, clown." And he calls me in with the finger, you know, motion to come to me, takes me out in the hall, grabs me by the shirt, lifts me up with one hand. I was like 80 pounds at the time. And he bangs me against the wall. You know, and he puts me down, and then I walk back into class all disheveled, my glasses sideways, and I'm like, no problem. I took care of it, you know. So.
And this was back in the 70s where in Catholic school they could do stuff like this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what did your parents say about that?
I don't think I told them about it.
Because you grew up in Bucktown,
yeah,
which is now a really hip neighborhood in Chicago.
Yeah.
But back when you were there in the 70s, it was rough.
It was a gang neighborhood.
And you were like a skinny kid, right?
Yeah.
Not good at sports. Yeah. How did you fit in?
My intelligence, I was always like one of the smartest kids in class, and my humor as a shield. So I could deflate things that I might have got beat up with by making the people that would beat me up laugh.
And then after high school, you go to DePaul for 7 years.
Yeah.
And you're one credit shy.
Yeah. It's probably... Okay, so degree in sociology, I got all the way up to handing in my final paper. It was a two-term advanced study thing where we had to do our own study. Mm-hmm. So we go out in the field and we take questionnaires and then we compile it and through the computer and everything. So I had done all the work until just handing in that final paper, and I just didn't do it. And I told myself, I'll go back someday. And like 10 years later, I decided to go back, and I went back and I talked to the whoever, because I was so far removed from being there. I was like in the adult comeback program or whatever. They were like, well, you know, you got to like finish up that particular thing. You can't, you know. I'm like, all right, you know, fine, I'll do that. And they go, you know what? It's been 10 years. You may not be able to do it again. We'll give you another class, like a 400 level anthropology or something. And then I was like, no, I got a failure in that because I never even, you know, I didn't hand in the paper and I got a failure, and I want that expunged from my records, you know? So I want to take that class again. And like, okay. So I took the class again, sat in on the class, very first class, teacher starts talking, and within, I'd say 15 seconds, it was like Greek. I didn't understand a single thing they were saying, and I simply, I did the Jack Brown is, and I slammed the book down, and I went out, and I stopped out for another 20 years and didn't take class. So I still have that one class to finish, but they've changed the requirements, so now I have to take electives as well that they didn't have before. The first time, 10 years, when I took that class that I did the in, I took electives then, and I was able to take whatever electives I want, so I took theater. So I took two theater classes, and it was great. I got to see all these plays for free at the Goodman and Steppenwolf, and it was fantastic, you know? So I'm going to do that again if it's an option, if I ever go back. But since my mother died, I don't really need to get my degree.
You know? Why does it matter because your mother died?
It was something that I know she, an accomplishment that she would have been proud of. You know, even though by the time my life took me to acting and I realized I don't need a college degree anymore, I'm this now, for her sake, it would have been like, you know, look, Mom, I got that degree.
Did she ever come to some of your improv and theater shows? Was she proud of how talented
you were?
It's really
weird. My mom was, and I, through years of therapy, and my mom was very judgmental and very withholding of affection. And she was an alcoholic. So I don't remember her ever saying out loud, ever, I love you, or I'm proud of you. But when she died, and I was going through all her things, she had a shopping bag full of every ad for every show I was in, of every playbill, of every, you name it, everything that she could get her hands on in ephemera of my career, she had it all there. So she was supporting me and paying attention, but she couldn't say it. It was so weird.
I get it. Because, you know, I had very neglectful parents, you know.
Plus, my dad died when I was 12.
Oh, how was that?
That was rough. I watched him die. So,
how did he die?
A heart attack.
So tell us the story, the day that he died that you watched him.
I heard sleeping, and my mom was screaming, and I jumped up out of bed, and I ran to see what was going on, and I sized it up right away that, you know, oh, man, my dad's having a heart attack. So she was in panic mode. She was just screaming, didn't know what to do. And just from watching movies and TV, I just like did my version of CPR or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was already gone. So
what was that like in terms of, I would feel angry, you know, especially you were in Catholic schools and stuff. And like, you know, God took your dad away from you and now you're stuck with your mom. Mm-hmm. And you're just having to be raised, especially as a boy, would be hard. What kind of feelings came up for you around that?
You know, I don't really know. And this is in therapy, we've discovered this. When I think back about my father, I have really no memories at all. I have specific incident memories, and all of those incidences were times when I remember that I felt that he didn't say it out loud, but I felt he had this feeling of, I wish I had a different son, or I wish I had a different son. This, I got stuck with this guy. you know. And so I'm like, I was 12 when he died. I should have a ton of memories of him. So am I blocking it? Am I, you know? And they're like, you know, let's not go back in the past and figure out why. Let's just fix you now. And so that was their version of therapy. So, yeah, I...
And then when you're in your 20s, you come to see a show at Second City.
Yeah, 27.
You were 27. And, yeah. Of course, someone from Chicago, you knew of Second City, yeah. Yet you hadn't been there. This was your first time.
Right.
So you're sitting in the audience,
yeah.
And what are you experiencing that first time you're watching main stage?
I'm experiencing a weight come off my shoulders of, that is what I want to do. I could do that. And what they're doing is something that I know I could do, and that's how I could do my living. I can do that. I don't have to drive a truck anymore. I don't have to paint houses anymore. I don't have to bartend anymore. I could do that. So that was my impetus for starting to take classes here.
And the thing that I love about your improvising is your characters. And you told me that, like, some of the characters you still do today, you did in some of your first classes.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell us how you develop your characters? Is it with a voice? Is it with a movement?
Most of my characters come from ear. So most of them are the accent, the dialect. And then from that, everything comes. Where some of those accents and dialects came from, I don't know. Obviously, it has to be stuff that I watched on TV, movies I saw, or people that I knew from the neighborhood or wherever. Because I didn't invent, you know, these voices, a new dialect or a new accent. So one example of, you know, an infinite amount of ones I can give you of how I found each character. The priest in Flanagan's Wake. Father Damon Fitzgerald.
Now, Flanagan's Wake was an improvised funeral.
Improvised Irish wake.
Right.
Yeah, hugely successful. I made a ton of money from it, made a ton of lifetime relationships and friends and all. Anyway, so my character, Father Damon Fitzgerald, I based him on two different people. And I didn't, like, pre-plan it and say, how am I going to find this character? Oh, I know, I'll take this guy and this guy. Didn't do it that way. I just instantly was the character. And then in retrospect, where is that coming from? And I realized, oh, it's coming from A, Barry Fitzgerald in The Quiet Man, and B, an old guy, schizophrenic guy from the neighborhood called him the Bug Man, because he would never even tell us his name, and he always thought bugs were on him. So those two characters gave me the character of Father Damon Fitzgerald. And obviously it's filtering through me, too. So
give me a little sample of what he would sound like.
Father Damon Fitzgerald?
Yeah.
Well, now, first of all, he's Irish, you know. And he believes he's a good priest, but really he's not. Likes to gamble, likes to drink. He's got a very dim grasp of the true Bible. He believes that there's a fifth book called the Book of Kevin. He's convinced of it. Conspiracy theorist. Very afraid of lemurs for some reason. I don't know why. He thinks they're a devil because of the eyes, I think. So there you go.
So if I said to him, like, the collection was a little off today, Father.
Because your thumb was probably on the scale with it.
Well, you sure you weren't at the boats again?
Yeah. You call me out on something that's a sin. I'm like a pig, and you're like the truffles. I sniff you out and see what you're doing wrong.
Well, I smell some booze on your breath.
Yeah, well, you know what? God, if he didn't want us to drink, he wouldn't have invented whiskey.
But when you did the Mass today,
yeah.
you forgot the whole homily. You just went right into communion.
That's details. You know, that's details. The important matters are the communion. Is that what I got to?
Yes,
you got... Well, then that was the important matter.
But everybody's there to hear a homily.
Yeah. Well, they were out of luck today, weren't
so
they?
So what was your homily today?
Today?
Yes, today, the one you were supposed to give.
Today... What was it supposed to be? Oh, it was about how we came to find loaves and fishes as a beginning to not eating meat on Fridays. You want to hear the story? I tell you the story.
No, I'm fine because I've heard the story the last four Sundays.
All right. Well, then there you are.
So did this character evolve as you were doing the show and you were finding different... aspects of him?
No, the character did not evolve. He was fully functional from the very first day I did him, but the bits that I was able to figure out and reuse. Because Flanagan's Wake is fully, it started out as a fully improvised show. Jack Bronis came up with the character sketches, like 3-4 sentences for each character, and he came up with the outline of the beats of the show. And it was based on a concept that Joe Liss had. We were doing a benefit show at the ETC, and we were standing outside afterwards, and Liss looks over at the Tony and Tina's marquee that just went up like a month or two before.
Which
that.
Tony and Tina's, for people who didn't know, was this Italian wedding improvised.
Right. It's like going, like with Flanagan's Wake, you're actually immersed, fully interaction. You're at an Irish wake. Tony and Tina's, you're fully interaction, immersed in an Italian wedding. So Liss looks at the marquee for them, and he says, yeah, somebody should do an Irish wake. Light bulb went off on Jack's head. He comes back, and he knows that we've got dead Friday nights at the Improv Institute. We're trying to figure out how do we, you know, we're canceling shows because we have no audience. What do we do? Well, let's try this Flanagan's Wake thing and see if it works, you know. So we came in, you know, all eight of us, and we had the outline. We had the character sketches. We might have ran a couple rehearsals with it, not very much. That very first night, we sold out, and we never looked back. It was a hit right from the start. So as the years went on, the fully improvised became a little more scripted, a little more scripted, a little more scripted, to where now it's maybe 20% improvised and the rest is, it's a play.
So what were you like when you first started out taking improv classes at Second City? Back in the, it was the 80s, right? It had to be.
Late 80s. Yeah. I think it started in 85, 86, somewhere in there. In hindsight, I was way more full of myself than I deserve to be.
And when you say that, what do you mean?
I guess from seeing the work, when I saw the main stage show, and from seeing the work of my fellow classmates, I was like, I got this. I'm good at this. This is something I can do, you know. But there was no training. There was no even reading books on it. I wasn't pursuing it academically at all. It was just I was a natural at it. So I would get up there, and I would be, in my opinion, good. And I probably was, you know. But in hindsight, it's like, boy, if I'd have been more humble, you know, and more zen about it, which I really wasn't for a long time, I probably could have did so much more for myself and for other people that I worked with at the time.
Well, I think, because I can relate to this, the humility part is, even now when I go do a show, if I'm going to learn something from it, it's much different than if I'm going to be like, I've got to be the standout. Have you experienced that?
I'm not sure. Say again, what was that?
Well, if I approach a show like, you know what, I still have something to learn. So I'm not going to worry about, oh, I'm going to be the star, I'm going to be the standout. What can I learn from when I work with John Hildreth? What can I learn from when I work with you? Because when I go in with the mindset of like, oh, I'm going to be the star, I'm going to be the standout, look at how great I am, my work usually suffers. And then I set up this expectation when the show's over, I'm beating myself up.
Yeah. I somewhere way back after I first started, I pretty quickly got over the thing of, I need to get the most laughs. I need to.
How'd you get over that? How'd you let go of that?
I guess I got lucky, and I worked with good people and the right people enough of the time to realize, oh, it's kind of fun to just set them up and let them, you know, do things as well. I know I can do the things too, but I don't have to do it all the time. You know, all together, we figure it out. So,
and would you say, this has been my experience, but I'd like your experience on this. When you're working with an ensemble on a consistent basis, which you have done, some nights, especially when you're doing long-form improv, some nights everyone's going to take a turn at being a star.
Right.
I would say T.J. Jagodowski is one person that every night, he to me, always stood out. But for the most part, everybody seems to have their turn. Yeah. Has that been your experience?
Yeah. Yeah, everybody seems to have their turn. I've been a firm believer of, if in that show all I needed to do was be a cactus to make the show work, that's fine. Because I know next time I'll be the cowboy and someone else will be the cactus. So,
here at the Second City Training Center in Chicago, you stress in your classes hard truth and realism.
Yeah.
Hard truth and realism.
Yeah, my mantra for them is real, feel, no bullshit.
Okay, so break that down. Real, feel, no bullshit. Start with the first part.
Real, you need the character to be a believable person, not a cartoon or a caricature. Even if the character is way out there, like a Kramer in Seinfeld, that character is way out there. But when we watch it, we believe there could be a person. I mean, he's based on a true person, you know. But we watch it. As nutty as he is, I can believe that that's a real person. That's not just a cartoonish version of a person. Fully functional, fully formed outlook on life, fully formed view of life, and real moments. So whatever moment you're having in the scene, and a scene is nothing but a series of moments, if it's done right, needs to be real. I need to believe it. Whatever what I tell my students is, you're not allowed to fuck a sheep in my class. And the example I give them is guy walks, two-person scene, lights go up, nobody knows what the other one's doing, it's improv. Guy walks in carrying what looks like a satchel or something, puts it down, rings an imaginary bell on a counter. The other person sees that and is like, oh, that's I guess it's a hotel. So it comes up to the counter. How can I help you, sir? Guy with the satchel. I'd like a room to fuck this sheep. Person on the other side of the counter. We got a lot of sheep fucking rooms. We got a room on the fifth floor that's all AstroTurf. Sheep might like that. We got a room on the fourth floor with a picture window, and it's of a meadow. And if there's sheep in the meadow and your sheep is the jealous type, I wouldn't take that room. So this guy is yes-anding the fuck out of fuck a sheep. Where in the world is there a hotel that you walk in and say, I want to fuck a sheep, and a guy's going to answer like that? Nowhere.
But where people get confused, Mark, is we were taught to yes and.
And I tell them, the guy saying, yeah, we got plenty of rooms to fuck a sheep in, is valid. It's a valid form of comedy. It's absurdist. Woody Allen, in Everything You Want to Know About Sex, had a vignette where Gene Wilder fell in love and fucked a sheep. And they made it work. It's absurdist. It's a valid thing. But I tell them, for the 8 weeks you're with me, you're going to learn how to not be absurdist. You're going to learn how to be real. And then you can take that little chunk of how to do this and add it to all the other little chunks, and you decide what style you like the most. Because when I perform with people that I don't know, like let's say the teacher jam or whatever, you never know what style is going to pop up in the show. You got to go with whatever it goes. So if they're going to do an IO absurdist kind of style, a self, commenting style like IO likes to do, I can go with that. I can do it. You know, it's not my favorite. It's not my cup of tea, but I can do it. So I just tell the students, just buy into this for 8 weeks and see if you like it.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
So let's say you're in a scene and I'm the guy who comes in and you're playing the front desk clerk at
right.
the hotel.
Right.
And I say, and we're going to take your idea and we're going to play this real, but I'm going to be the jerk who comes in and says, the jerky student who comes in and says, I want to fuck a
sheep. No, that's the thing. The student that comes in and says, I'd like a room to fuck this sheep, that's totally believable.
Right.
It's totally valid.
Right.
There could be a nut out there that actually really does that in life.
Right. So I'm saying, let's do it now where I come in and you're playing the clerk.
Play it the way I want it to be played.
Yeah, play it however you like to be played. So
okay.
I'm coming in, I'm the clerk, and I'm like, hey, I'd like to get a room to fuck a sheep.
Okay.
All right?
All right, go
great.
Ahead.
I would, I'm looking for a room
because
mm-hmm. I don't need it for a long time.
Okay, well, you can stay as long as you want, but the room is booked for 24 hours.
Okay, great, so. Because I'm going to fuck a sheep.
Okay.
Did I say something funny?
Yeah, I mean, come on, you know.
So can I get a room?
Are you serious?
Yeah. She's in the car. Well, a truck.
Okay, did Jack put you up to this? Did he tell you to come in here and say this, really?
No.
Okay, sir. Okay. First of all, we don't allow any type of animals in the hotel unless they're service animals.
Okay, but it said it was a dog-friendly hotel.
It's not a dog, it's a sheep.
Okay.
And I'm doubting it's a service sheep?
It's not.
Okay, so by law, we can't have the animal in the building. All right, but that's That's not the real issue here. The real issue is that you know
here's $40.
Yeah, that's
a lot of money.
Yeah, no, it's not going to do it. It's not about the money. It's not about the money, sir. It's not about the money. It's like I can't do it. I can't do it. And frankly, if I was in a position of my manager or the owner of the hotel to be able to decide whether or not to do it, I wouldn't let you do it because it's fucked up.
Okay, so tell me how you decided to play that.
Real.
Just how you would really, if you were really the clerk,
right.
That's how you would really.
Right, we filter all of our characters through who we are, even if they're far removed from our point of view of life or close to us. You know, some actors, they always do characters that are pretty much very close to them. You know, and other actors are, you know, all over the place, far away from them. That's all valid as long as it's believable. So for this particular character, I just kind of did what would I do if I was in that situation as the hotel desk clerk, and I responded like that.
So what about the student in the back who goes, but Mark, you guys weren't yes-anding each other.
I would say in level A, it's totally valid. In level B, it's totally valid. Depending on the teacher you have, do whatever they tell you. I'm telling you, you can't fuck a sheep in my class for 8 weeks and see how you like that when you're done with it.
But also in the scene that we were doing, mm-hmm. disagreeing was actually forwarding the scene.
Oh yeah. I mean, I have been following your blog for years, and it always makes me feel so much more. It gives me confidence as a teacher because I see so many things in there. That it's like, yeah, I do that. Oh, thank God. Jimmy does that too. Now I know it's right. You know, like one of the things. So that's one of the things. It's like, if you have to say no, say no. As long as it's actor agreement, I'm agreeing with you that we're in this situation of you want to fuck a sheep and I'm the desk clerk and I'm trying to deal with this. I could say no and it still validates the situation we're in. It moves it forward. It's just we tell students in level A, say yes all the time, because if you have an equal chance between yes and no, yes usually makes the scene more successful and makes it easier to do.
And when they're starting out, you're just playing the percentages there.
Yeah.
Because
you just want them to have success.
Right. And most tendencies when people come into a beginning improv class, they're saying no.
They don't know the difference yet between the character saying no and their inner spirit saying no. So the more you get them to not say no early on, it kind of frees them up to be kids again and not say no. I just learned recently, TJ, he does a really, really great thing. I'm going to steal it from him in class. He gets them all circled up, and he goes, how many of you can dance? One or two students raise their hands. How many of you can sing? One or two students raise your hands. How many of you can draw? One or two raise their hands. He goes, you know, if I asked you that when you were 5 years old, everybody would raise their hand. That's brilliant. That's fucking brilliant. So in level A, I want them all raising their hands, you know, and hopefully by C, they can see the difference between the actor agreeing and the character agreeing.
I almost think that scene that we just did would be a good game, to have somebody come up and make a ludicrous thing like I'm going to fuck a sheep, mm-hmm. and they have to play it real.
Yeah.
And speaking of, is there any kind of exercise or game that you use to teach people to play hard truth and realism?
Hundreds.
Can you share one with us?
But that one. I took a version of auditions at Second State. I don't know what they do anymore, but in the early days, they used to do five through the door or ten through the door.
You had to do like five characters.
Yeah.
You
have to come in as a character real quickly. You deal with someone that's behind a desk, a help desk or a hotel desk or whatever, and you turn around and do the next character. Well, I simply took that and I turned it into I call it an uber realism scene. So everybody does both. Everybody gets to be a character and everybody gets to be the hotel desk clerk. All right. So the hotel desk clerk, they have to do everything down to the most specific detail. So if they don't ask for the credit card and ID, that wasn't good enough. I need to see the credit card and ID. If somebody gives you cash in the hotel, hotels don't take cash. You have to have a credit card on file. So they have to do all those little incidental things, which teaches them, I don't have to worry about being funny or anything. I just have to worry about being real. So the more real I make all these little detail things, the easier it is for me not to worry. And I give one lay on to the hotel desk clerk. I say, but you never, no matter what the other person gives you, you never get angry, you never get snotty, you never get snippy. You always are acting as though your manager is watching over your shoulder. You're just doing whatever you would do as a hotel desk clerk. And the other person can be whatever character they want and come in for whatever reason they want.
But they both have to play the reality of whatever the transaction
is. Whatever the transaction
is. So if I want to check in for a room, I got to give you my credit card. He's going to run it through. Yep. If it gets declined, could I see another credit card?
Yep.
All of those details.
Yeah.
But the person coming in can be a character. What about the person behind the counter?
The person behind the counter is going to simply be whatever kind of hotel desk clerk they want to be, as long as they never get angry, snotty, or snippy, or sarcastic at all. No matter, like, if the guest is like, you're a fucking idiot, how the fuck could you do this? Sir, I'm so sorry if I was in your situation. I understand I would be feeling the same way, but there's really nothing I can do about it. There is no smoking in the hotel, that kind of thing.
Which is really good, lay-on, because 99% of the hotels or any service industry you're going to, people aren't going to give you a snide remark or something like that. They're working there, and they don't want to lose their job.
So, and then there's side things to this uber realism hotel desk clerk thing that I do, and that is, you know, beginning improvisers always get into those fuck you scenes.
Yeah.
You're a bad roommate. You're a bad roommate, too. You always stretch my sweaters when you put them on. Yeah, well, you don't pay the rent, whatever. And the only way you can heighten and go to something is to have a fist fight. And then after that, what do? Then the scene starts, you know? So rather than do that, the way you can diffuse that is somebody gets really pissed and mad at you and whatever. It's our natural instinct to fight back or to even to you diffuse it by saying you're right. You're absolutely right. I do. And I do a circle exercise with them where I have one person, they go in order, and I have one person just lay into the other person about the most stupid thing in the world. Like, I can't believe that you had no staples in the stapler. How could you have a stapler on your desk without staples? Are you a fucking idiot? So on and on for a good 30, 45 seconds of screaming at them, and then the other person has to respond in the most low-status, deferential way at all. They can't even say, yeah, I know, but the reason I. The minute they say the reason I, they're defending themselves. They just need to say, you're right. I'm a fuck up. I've always been a fuck up. I don't deserve to live. You're right. I don't know what else to say. And then they flip it. Then that person becomes the one angry and screaming and high status.
I can't believe, Mark, that you took my sweater, my best sweater. Didn't you know that I had a date tonight? What the fuck were you thinking when I... Oh, you are the worst roommate I have ever seen. You know what? I should kick you out right now because this isn't the first time you've done it, Mark. This is not the first time you've... Are you listening to me, Mark? Mark, are you fucking listening to me? Because I am... Right now, I should fucking throw all your stuff out on the street.
I wish I wasn't like this. I wish I wasn't me. I feel so bad. If you killed me right now, I would feel better than I feel right now.
Well, you know, I have a gun. I have a gun in the closet. And I right now, I should go there and get the gun and shoot you right here.
You should. You should.
You are pathetic. Do you know that?
Yeah, I know. That's
okay.
Yeah.
And what does that accomplish?
It comes a couple of things. It teaches them high status, low status, so they know that in a scene, if a scene's not working, there's two things you can always do to fix a scene if it's not working instantly. You can't go back in time and fix it. We all know been in that place in a scene where, man, something's not working here. I don't have time to analyze why.
That is the worst feeling.
Yeah, I know, it just feels like shit. So what do? Change your emotion or change your status. If you're playing low status, for some reason, find a reason that you're going to get high status right there. You know, I'm going to start, no matter what, I know I should be getting my moments from instinct of the moment, but sometimes we have to cheat it, you know, because we're entertaining an audience and we know things aren't working in a scene. So no matter what Jimmy says to me next, I'm just going to start crying about it. No matter what it is, the most innocuous thing he says to me, I'm just going to start crying about
it. But make a strong choice.
Yeah.
You're saying don't play it subtle. You're going to have to make a strong choice.
Yeah. And that can oftentimes get you back on track, and then that scene can work from there.
I don't know why I picked a gun. I don't ever like going to guns, do you?
You know, when the last time we did Jimmy and Johnny, when we were the cowboys,
yes,
and you were my brother,
yes,
and you pulled out the knife and killed me,
yes,
I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Well, thank you. But I always feel bad, like killing people or violent. What do you think that's about?
Why did I love it?
No, yeah, I want to know why you loved it. Yeah,
because you had the balls to do it.
Okay,
you know, You had the balls to do it. And I could tell from working with you that you weren't afraid, oh, if I do this, I'm going to fuck up the scene. You were like, Mark will figure something out.
Right.
And I did.
Well, I love working with you.
I love working with you.
I just... okay, so improv has grown so much since we first started. And you started before I did. Well, we probably started around the same time. What is your biggest fear about improv today?
The political correctness that's creeping in, that's becoming more pervasive. And I always have to, as I'm feeling this, I always have to keep asking myself, am I just the cranky old white guy and I'm seeing it through a lens that isn't current, isn't modern, you know? And then the artist in me is like, no, you know, it's valid to explore comedy in all sorts of ways. And then I'll talk to my fellows about it and they're like, Mark, the stuff that happened 40 years ago that was groundbreaking is just simply not allowed to be done today. And the rebel in me that goes all the way back to when I was in grammar school being a smartass is like, why? Why is it not done today? Why can't it still be done? So.
In this conversation.
I'll give you a perfect example.
Yeah.
Blazing Saddles, mm-hmm. right?
Okay. Mel Brooks' classic.
Right, okay. Well, the N-word is used.
Yes.
And it's used very well. It's not gratuitous.
Now, let's just put this in context. That movie came out in the late 70s?
71, 72, I
okay.
think.
Okay, well, it's early 70s.
Right. Yeah. So that would not be allowed today. And I know for a fact there are plenty of teachers that would never have allowed that movie or scene to ever take place because of that. So that's the, am I a dinosaur or have things changed and I'm saying, and I'm fighting the good fight of it should not be like this. I'm still questioning.
So let me ask you this, and this doesn't ever seem to come into this conversation, but to me it seems, as a teacher and as a performer, it seems to be a generational thing. There's the older generation that we are, which is certainly less politically correct than the younger generation. Now, how can these two generations work together? How can we respect each other's boundaries in performance and in class?
I mean, you know, the answer to anything where you have two disparate views and how do we come to some understanding is empathy, you know, and empathy, putting yourself in the other person's shoes, getting down on your knees with them on their knees, looking in their eyes and just totally listening and trying to understand why and vice versa. So that's the way to do it, to have that dialogue. But, it's a rough one, you know? It's like abortion, anti-abortion. It's, you know, it's like some things, it's like, how are you ever going to come together? And that's what I'm afraid of. I think as this was evolving, there was a time when the two sides were still kind of had a middle ground. You know, the two-circle thing on a graph chart where there's that center? I think those circles are becoming where they're totally apart now, where they're not even a little bit of, well, yeah, I can understand that, or I can understand this. Because, like, one of the arguments that I made about, what do you mean you can't do an ethnicity unless you're that ethnicity? I mean, I grew up, you know, where you do as many different characters as you can. That's your bread and butter, you know. Eddie Murphy did a great white Jewish guy. He was black at the time, you know. I can name all these actors who are not the ethnicity who did these great characters, you know, in movies and in plays and whatever. And again, I talk to my peers and bring that up as a defense, devil's advocate, whatever you want to say about that. I don't like this political correctness thing. What about that? They're like, yeah, that wouldn't happen nowadays. You would not cast them in, if they're not, if Yul Brynner, you know, look at all the different ethnicities he played. He couldn't have been all those different ethnicities. So, you know, it's like, I don't know what he was, but he played this, he played that, he played that. Well, now I guess he can only play what he really was? That doesn't make any sense. That means women can't play men anymore, and men can't play women anymore, and, you know, I mean, I don't know where the line is. And believe me, it's like I'm not being a stubborn ass about, you know, fuck you, I'm still going to do my characters, whatever. I'm trying to understand, but it's hard for me.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. If you're a seasoned improviser and you're looking for a new approach and maybe even a little inspiration to your scenic improv, then I'd like to help. If you're in Chicago this July and or August, I'll be offering my Artist Loc Comedy Weekend Summer Intensive. If you're already coming into Chicago, why not take the opportunity to study with me and improvisers from all over the world, learning my unique slow comedy approach to improv that makes it as easy as having a conversation. The Artist Loc Comedy Weekend Summer Intensives will be taking place on the weekends of July 14th and 15th, July 28th and 29th, and August 11th through 12th. To register or for more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
When we were at the Improv Institute and we used to have costumes in the back, so if we needed something in the moment, we'd run in the back, put a costume on, and come out, and that was part of the shtick of the Improv Institute. I always say this, it's kind of jokingly, but it's kind of true. It's like if a sick would come in with the turban and all, I'm in the back looking for a turban. I'm putting that turban on. I'm gonna be a sick in one of those scenes. The point is, I'm not gonna be a sick to make fun of that sick. I'm gonna be a sick so that I can be a truthful, real sick, and he could look at that and say, hey, thanks. Thanks for empowering me and showing me as a real person up there. Thank you. You know, I did a scene with Susan Messing, two of my most favorite shows ever were the two I did with her.
She's wonderful.
Oh,
isn't
my God.
She?
She is just
a genius. You don't have to even work with her.
I once saw her do a show. I'm not going to name a name, but I once saw her do a show with a person I knew was wretched. Just wretched, horrible. And she must have been doing a kindness or whatever to say, you do the show with me. And I went to see the show purposely to see how is she going to deal with this. She reminded me of, you ever see those sheepdogs that wrangle the sheep?
Yes.
That's what she did the whole 50 minutes. She just wrangled that guy. He was still doing bad work. She wrangled him in such a way that the show was good. It was amazing. It was just amazing. So anyway, I did a show with her. And biggest compliment she gave me was, you broke me twice in that show, motherfucker. And I'm like, wow, I broke Susan Messing. So one of the scenes we just morphed to, I decided I'm going to play my version of Stephen Hawking. Mm-hmm. So I just I got myself physically like Stephen Hawking, and I decided I'm going to do the computer voice for this character. So I did that. And she didn't know it was coming, and I just came at her again. I think this date is going really well. And that was the start of the scene.
Right.
And I could hear some people in the audience gasp, like, how could he do that, you know? And by the end of the scene, it was like, that was good.
So this is interesting. So you're doing that Stephen Hawking's character.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you hear the audience gasp.
Yeah.
Now, does Mark double down?
Yeah.
So tell me the process when you're there and you hear this gasp and you're like, what do I do?
That's the smartass in me. I was talking with a friend of mine about this very recently. He was talking about people who, when you look in their eyes on stage, they're just naturally funny. John Hildreth is one of those people. Mm-hmm. You look in his eye, he's always twinkling.
Yes.
And the stuff that he comes up with comes from that twinkliness, yeah. You know? So when I look in people's eyes, you know, certain actors that I work with, I see a, let's do this, motherfucker. Let's do this, yeah. And we go for it. So that's the feeling that I get. When they go, it's like, all right, yeah. So I tell my students, in my advanced students, all the time you get that smartass in the audience with, can we have a location? Gynecologist's office! A million times. Everybody knows that's the cliche. And the way you diffuse it as the caller is, we get that all the time. We need something else, you know. So I tell my students, you know what you do? Take it and do a really good scene in a gynecologist's office. Don't make it about the gynecologist's office. Don't make it, you know, gratuitous. Just do a good scene. Even if you're talking the whole time in the gynecologist's office about whatever, that's another thing. That I there's like a million things that I take from you that I'm like, yeah, yeah, Jimmy does that too, yeah. One of the things is the suggestion is just a suggestion, all right? It's not, you don't have to do it. It's just an inspiration for something. So even if you're as succinct as, can I have a relationship for these two? And the audience shouts out, brothers. They don't have to be brothers in that scene. You know, can I have a relationship for these two? And the comma after that that is understood is, can I have a relationship for these two to inspire them to do whatever they're going to do? So in that scene, even if the scene starts with, hey, look at this, you got nothing but Band of Brothers on your DVD, you know, that's it. If you do a good scene, by the end of the scene, the audience doesn't care that you didn't use the suggestion literally. They're like, that was just a good fucking scene. Yeah, thank you.
Or a lot of people will read into it say, you know.
That's the beauty of the audience is we're human beings, you know. We see a piss stain underneath the highway and it's like, that's the Virgin Mary. I'm going to get some roses, you know. They do that all the time in shows. You know, by the end of the long form, by the end of the scene, whatever, they're like, three different audience members in their head. That was a scene about honesty. The other one, that was a scene about women cheating on men. The other one, that was a scene about Trump. They always make sense of the scene if it's a good scene. Always.
Now, you said that your life was a mess and you started to get things together in the last 4 years.
Realistically, probably starting. I mean, it was always in there floating around, but I always let the demons. And I mean, it was always in me of, I know what I should be doing to be better. You know, I got this giant list of I shoulds, you know,
were you a mess?
I'm a lifetime depressive. I suffer from anhedonia.
What is anhedonia?
Anhedonia is where, you know, this is the thing. I never knew that was supposed to be the original name of Woody Allen's Annie Hall. Anhedonia was supposed to be her name. Anhedonia is where when you wake up in the morning, a normal person is like, you know what? Yeah, I'm up again. This is good. It's going to be fun. It's life. I would wake up in the morning and be like, oh, fuck, I got to get through this one. That's anhedonia. You have no comprehension of just being okay and together is how you should be.
But wouldn't that make sense? Your mom was an alcoholic. Your dad dies at 12.
Yeah, and my mom was, I don't want to Before I tell you some bad stuff about mom, let me tell you, the last few years of her life, our relationship changed, and I was totally able to. She died 10 years ago. Real quick, she had a stroke, and 6 months later, she was dead. But I was totally able to. It wasn't a process. I was just able to realize she loved me in her way. She did the best she could with what she had. And that's it. She wasn't a great mother. She was not. That's all there is to it. But it wasn't her fault. She didn't purposely be a bad mother. That's just the way it was. That's it, you know? Somebody's got it worse. Somebody's got a mother that burns them with cigarettes and stuff, you know? It's like, so everybody's getting, it's all gradiated. But my mom, for example, she grew up and she was of the mind of your worth is based on how you look, how you physically look, how you dress.
All about appearances.
All about appearances. That's it, you know. So there was one day, and so obviously from birth until as I was growing up, she was subliminally putting that in my head. Plus, I grew up in a neighborhood where I was skinny and no good in sports. And so one day I was questioning if I'm good looking. I must have been, I don't know, 11 years old, 10 years old, questioning if I'm good looking and what handsome means and whatever. And my mom's sitting at the kitchen table reading the newspaper, and I go, I'm on a floor plane or something. I go, Mom, am I handsome? And she puts the paper away from her face and looks at me for a couple seconds and goes, no, not really. And she wasn't kidding. She puts the paper back and she's reading it, and I guess she thought, oh, I fucked up. I shouldn't have said that. So she puts the paper down. Here's how she fixes it. I mean, not like Robert Redford or Paul Newman. And she puts the paper back and just keeps reading it. So that's one. I could give you 1,000 examples of mom.
How many
doing
times
stuff like
has that come up in therapy?
A lot.
And what was the resolution?
The resolution was, let's not try to understand the past. Let's just give you coping mechanisms to deal with now. So because I always thought I was of the Freudian mind of, if I could just analyze my past in enough detail, I could figure out why I'm so fucked up, and then I would instantly be cured. Because now I know. Now I know all the reasons why. And it's like, now it's just the exact opposite. Now I don't give a fuck about the reasons why. I just want to be okay today again.
So you were a mess.
A mess.
Okay, so give me an example more of...
Of being a mess?
Yeah.
Lifetime. I discovered marijuana when I was 16 years old, and I never looked back. And
daily smoker?
Oh, God, yeah. Okay. Oh, man. I mean, it was like, you know, really, really, really good weed now. I mean, the kind where you smell it and you're like, whoa. And it's like, you know, the buds look white because there's so much THC on them. My friends would one or two hits of that, and that's it for the day. I could do 20, you know. I just built up that kind of a tolerance. And so I've been sober now for over four years. And I had moments of playing with sobriety all those years of my whole life, but then I always go back. And I realized in this 4 year period, it's real. And my friends are like, well, come on, just try one, whatever, weekend, whatever. I'm like, you know what? Here's the thing. If I get high, if I take one puff now, for some reason, the wiring of my brain goes to instantly, well, I'd rather feel like this all the time than sober. And then that's it.
Yep.
That's it. So.
Yep. So. I suffer from a lot of addictions, and it comes down to this. One time someone offered me a piece of candy because I don't eat sugar one day at a time. And I'm like, you know what? I don't want one piece. I want the whole box, and I want to go home, and I want to be alone, and that's it, you know? There's no, like, social interaction. There's no fun to it anymore. It's just like, and it doesn't matter what addiction I have. That's where it leads me alone. Suicidal thoughts. I hate myself.
Oh,
all that shame. Yeah. So what changed?
Well, I guess over time, as I got older, I was in therapy, you know, lifetime of therapy and all.
So you're going to therapy and you were still getting
high. I was getting better in little, getting better in little increments. Oh, here's the thing about high. I would, if I was doing a gig, if I was going out with people, you know, for an evening or whatever, I wouldn't be high at all. I would only get high when I knew it was the end of the day. I'm not seeing anybody anymore. I'm just settling down and that's it, you know. But I realize in hindsight, I set up so much of my life schedule, what I'm going to do with my life, what I'm going to do for a living, whatever, so I could have those large chunks of alone time to get high. And that kept me isolated, kept me away from people, kept me the opposite of what I should be as a good improviser, you know, and a good liver, you know, of wanting to be with other people and help other people and all that. But I would still say, in spite of all that, I was aware of things, and with therapy and everything, I was gradually getting a little better, a little better, a little better, a little better. About a year ago, less than a year ago, like right around middle of summer last year, I realized I'm going to be 60 in October. And it just hit me, I don't have much time left. Because, like, think about it. When you're reading the paper and you see somebody that was like 71 died, you don't say, oh, my God, he was so young. You're just like, yeah, that's about right. Well, that's 11 years from now. I got 11 years. You know, let's say, oh, Mark, nah, you got 20. You got 23, 25 years left. Okay, good. I'm 80 years old. You ain't going to be this Mark now. It's going to be 80-year-old Mark, no matter how young a mind I have, you know. So it's like, fuck, what am I going to do? All these things I should be doing, all the shoulds, you know. And something in me just said, calm the fuck down. Just start doing it. So I did. So, the other thing is, I always tell myself whenever my birthday, like as soon as I have my 60th birthday, I start telling myself I'm 61. So that way when 61 comes, I'm not like, fuck, I just turned 61. I've been telling myself I'm 60. So I was telling myself I was 60 when it's from 59. So as October was approaching, I'm like, you know what? I always wanted to get a tattoo. So I got a tattoo. Yes and. The Yes and band on my arm. I always wanted to, I always said I should meditate. I always tried and I always failed at it because too many thoughts were in my head and I would try all the different points of focus and I just couldn't do it. And I don't know, part of it is just dumb luck. I looked up online something about meditating and I was like, oh, there's this breathing technique. There's this 4-7-8 breathing technique. It's supposed to calm anxiety and situationally and help you sleep and all. I said, fuck it. I'm going to try it just to meditate, you know. First time I tried it, it worked. I mean, it worked.
When you say it worked.
I was able to quiet my mind and just have a minimum of thoughts. And when those thoughts came in, I didn't get frustrated and angry. I was like, yeah, it's normal for thoughts to come in. I'm just going to push it away and just focus on that breathing and on the counting of the breathing and all. And I kept building up and building up and building up. And I eventually got to 20 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon of this meditating. And I haven't missed a day since the very first day I started. And it has changed my life. I mean,
in what way? When people say it's changed your life, meditation, how?
I am much less selfish. I am much, much less negative. I was a horribly negative person. Somebody would say something, I'd always see the negative. Yeah, but I'll tell you this why. And I'm so grateful for everything. I'm so fucking grateful now. It's just unbelievable.
And how has that spilled into your performance and teaching?
Well, I've always loved teaching. It made me aware of why I love teaching.
Why do you love teaching?
Because if it's done correctly, it has nothing to do with you. It's all about them. What can I do to make them be better improvisers and, as Marty would say, better livers of life, you know? As actors, and as the way I was raised and all, actors are such selfish people, you know? It's my audition, it's my headshot, it's my resume, it's my time, it's this and that and all. If you're a good actor, you know, the only times that you're unselfish is in those moments when you're with your scene partner, if you're doing it right. And there's plenty of actors that are selfish there. And they're just thinking about how can I get, you know. So if you're doing it right, it's like, I'm just going to make this guy look. I would make the reader look good when I'm auditioning in front of the camera, you know, at one of the casting agents. So that's the only time you're really selfless is in that moment of acting. Everything else is me, my, me, my, me, my. And teaching is the opposite. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just the vessel. I got to figure out how to make them better. You know, and yesterday, this is so serendipitous being here today with you. Yesterday, I had one of the, if not the most satisfying experiences of my life as a teacher. I had a level F show last night.
And that's kind of more advanced.
When you graduate from level E at Second City, if you want to continue on with the same group and you still want to be in a comfortable setting of being in a structure like Second City and not just start producing on your own and trying to find rental space. And, you know, a lot of students, even at level E, they don't know how to put up their own show yet, but they still want more. Second City offers them level F, where you can continue on. You pick the teacher of your choice and you kind of tell that teacher, this is what we'd like to work on. So I had my level.
So that's an honor for you that they asked.
Yeah, if they ask you, you feel good. Like, oh, they thought I was good enough that they want more from me, you know. We were having a rough time as a group. There was friction in the group. There was tension. There was, and as the show was approaching and we were rehearsing and all, it just wasn't working.
And they were doing an improv or a sketch show?
Oh, improv. Okay. All improv. And we had eventually ended up on deciding to do, half of them were going to do, half the show was going to be Spoon River and the other half was going to do a bat, you know? And, it just wasn't working. And at the end of the class, that was our rehearsal, last class before the show, the tension, the self-doubt, all the horrible negative stuff that you could possibly have was amongst them and there. And I just racked. I brought in Jack Bronis to teach one of my classes because I was running out of, I don't know how to fix this, you know. And Jack said, you know, just do your best. So between the last class and the show, I'm like, okay, I don't know what to do here. I don't want them to fail. I love them. They're so earnest. They want so well to be good. They have their moments of being real, but then they fall back into this shticky, try to get a laugh, not being real thing. I guess it's fear or whatever. And I couldn't break them as a group to just always be real and honest and everything. Like I said, they all had their moments and all. So I'm thinking, okay, they can do it. Because I've seen them. When I made them do dramatic scenes in class, they were brilliant, you know. But when I leave them to their own on a montage, they don't do it. So I didn't have enough time to work with them to figure out why, whatever. And I was panicking. The show was coming. And then I just decided, you know what? Fuck it. I'm throwing everything out the window. I'm going to fucking lay down the law. I'm going to say, I know you guys are supposed to pick your own show because it's level F, but I'm going to be, I'm pulling rank. So I walked in an hour before the show and I said, listen, and I explained, you know, how bad feelings were and how everything that was happening in class was the opposite of what we should be doing. We should have each other's back. We should be doing everything to try to make everyone else better. We should have all the boats need to rise together, all that stuff, you know. And I said, we didn't have any of that and we're not going to have it tonight if we continue on. So you guys are doing a fully improvised fucking play. And they just like, we don't even know what that is. I go, don't worry. I'll get the gets at the top. I'll do the intro. I'll get the gets. And here's what you guys are going to do. You're going to come out and you're going to do a two-person scene. Then you two are going to do a two-person scene. And you two, then you two. You're each going to be the same character for the whole thing. The light booth will cut it in a theatrical way with long dark until you're set and everything. And that's what you're fucking doing. And that's it. No, but, no, but, no, nothing, but. Fuck you. That's what you're doing. They went out there and they killed. for 32 people on in a 103-seat house, the Skybox, on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock. They went out there and killed.
And then what was their response when they came back after the show? You gave them notes, and they said,
I don't give them notes after the show. I didn't give them notes.
Why don't you give them notes after the show?
I let them have their time to have their laurels on their head and to let their audience tell them how wonderful they were. When we get back to class the following week, that's when they get notes.
What did they say when they got back to class?
We didn't get back to class. That was their last show. I'm not going to see them again.
But did they come up to you and say you were right, or you thank you so much, or I was really scared, or any of that? Did you get any of that feedback? I mean, you certainly got it because you saw the response from the audience and their performance.
I didn't get any of that feedback. Like, you're a genius, Mark, to have switch gears on us like that. That was the thing we needed. They were just so into, oh, God, that was so good. Wasn't that great? That was so much fun hugging each other. Before that show, this is the capper. Before that show, I was saying to them, well, you've got this other show coming up that Second City promised you because they give you such a bad slot at 10 o'clock on Sunday night. Second City felt bad about that, so they said, we'll give you another show in the Beat Lounge or something to make up for the 10 o'clock Sunday night thing, because they were afraid they had an audience on that time, you know. So when I said, so what's going on with that show, it was like, yeah, I can't do it because I got a work schedule that's really bad, and then another one, you know, yeah. I mean, so you could see they were dropping out because of the tension and friction and whatever, you know. Well, at the end of the show, they were all like, we're all doing that show, right? Yeah, they're all doing the show together now. So,
but I think those are the most rewarding classes as a teacher, because for me, it forces you to, like, trust your instincts and improvise with them. You're like, maybe if you looked at it, like, maybe I was missing something, or maybe I wasn't meeting them. And then at the 11th hour, you're like, you know what? I'm changing courses here.
I couldn't have done that a year ago. All my life as a teacher, I always, like everything in my life, whether it's my acting, my improvising, my teaching, whatever, I always question myself. I always feel like a fraud. I always feel eventually somebody's going to say, what, you think you can teach? You can't teach. This is teaching, you know, and it's like, so I'm always, that's why I love you so much, because I read your stuff and it gives me validation. It's like, okay, if Jimmy's doing it, I know I'm doing something right, you know. So lately, I'm feeling much more, I still don't have it. I have a lifetime to learn. I'll never learn everything, but I'm feeling much more comfortable with my decisions. And I'm finding that this last year especially, I'm not sticking to that curriculum. I would stick to a curriculum, and I would tweak up a few things every class, and as the terms went on, it was, you know, kind of, but I kind of stayed sort of. Now I take it in and I wing it, and I invent games. I'm doing all sorts of things I never would have done before because I would have been afraid to. I'm not afraid to anymore.
And that's the kind of that's the kind of teaching I love to do, where you're improvising with the class. If they're stuck on something, you know what? There is no lesson plan.
I gotta figure
it's
something.
Right in the moment, right
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Let's work on that, because that's what you bought the class.
Yeah. I mean, you know? You even do that with beginning students. It's like if they're playing Zip Zap, I've read it. You've said that if they're Zip Zap Zop and somebody morphs it into Zip Zap Zip, Zip Zap right. Zoop, whatever, you're like, let go, have fun, go, guys.
Yeah, because to me, it's like, the warm-up games is just to get them out of their head and not like, oh, have to do everything perfectly. Because I'll have people put their hands up and ask questions about Zip, Zap,
Zap. Well, that's the beauty of my real feel no bullshit mantra is I tell them, yeah, so many of these games have rules attached to them. And the reason they have rules is the audience loves to see us do these things with rules. And it gives us more focus. That's why we have ABC or whatever, you know. Takes you less out of your thinking head. And I focus on the rules. I'm focusing on the moment. I go, but you know what? I'd rather you give me a really good, believable scene and totally fuck up the rules than be letter perfect with the rules and be a robot up there. And that usually calms them down.
Well, know? I believe it. And I'm with you 100%. And I also think it's like, it's the beginning. Like, if you get a good scene out of that and they don't follow the rules, who cares?
Yes, the audience doesn't care.
No.
You know? As long as you, at the end of it, if it's good, if the audience is crying, that's the other thing I tell them. I go, I'm like Dell. I don't want fucking laughs. I just want emotion. I want them to feel. I want the audience to feel stuff. If you do a whole show and you don't get a single laugh, but they're crying at the end, believe me, they won't complain and they won't say, that show sucked. It's supposed to be Second City. It's supposed to be funny.
How do you get them to buy into that? Because that's the hardest thing. And I even struggle it as an improviser doing it for so
long. There's only one way. They have to experience it themselves. They have to experience the success of doing it that way. And hope that the light bulb goes off and they can do the comparison of, oh, yeah, when I did it this way, it felt like this. But when I'm doing it this way, it feels like that.
But I did it this way, Mark, and it was a good scene, but I didn't get laughs. And I did it the other way, and it got laughs, yeah. And it was and kind
I,
of a hacky
I
scene.
Tell him, you know what? I could pull my dick out, put a firecracker in the tip of it, light it, and it'll explode, and it'll get a laugh from the audience. But that's not a fulfilling moment. That's just shtick. That's just a gimmick.
So how do you get them comfortable with doing a good scene that doesn't get laughs?
I guess I tell them that that's good. Do it that way. Don't worry about laughs. I don't know. I mean, you know.
And do they know when it's done that it's a good scene?
Well, here's the thing. The worst, and I get this rarely, but the worst moment I have as a teacher when I'm like in my head, I'm like, oh God, is this going to be work? Is when they do a horrible fucking scene in class and at the end of it, they're high-fiving. It's like, oh man. Oh man. I don't know what to do here. But usually they don't. Usually when it's bad, they know it's bad. And usually when it's good, I would say 85, 90% of the time, when they're high-fiving or fist-bumping or whatever, and when it's over, it was good. And that makes my job so much easier because at least they're getting an internal sense of what's good and what's not good. They don't know why yet. They don't know the specifics of why, but at least they can feel that worked for some reason. That didn't work for some reason. I can give them the specifics of why it did and why it didn't. And hopefully over years, you know, they get it.
Because sometimes I'll get students, they'll do great scenes, yeah. And they'll say, but we didn't get any laughs, or that wasn't very funny. And, you know...
I tell them, I don't give a fuck. I don't care if it's funny. It doesn't need to be funny. I go, in the course of a whole show, the funny will come because people are naturally funny, you know? I do an exercise with them, very first class, with all my classes, I do an exercise where I say... 99% of the time, I'm going to tell you, always be a character. Don't be yourself 100% on stage because then there are places that you'll wall off. You will, because I go, if you're a character, then you can tell yourself, well, you know, I wouldn't do it, but my character could. So then you're.
I guess it gives you more freedom.
Free to go anywhere, right. So I tell them, but for this exercise, I want you to be your real self, okay? Be your real self and do everything you would do if it was really you in this situation I'm going to put you in. So don't make up anything unless it's truthful to you. So if you would just sit there and say nothing, then just sit there and say nothing. That's all I want you to do. It's an exercise. So I set up three chairs, and like the two of you are, and I give them some parameters. You got to be strangers. You're not allowed to get up and leave if that's what you would do. And you have no objects of any kind to hide behind. Nothing. All right? And just react however you react. Talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I'll say, okay, two of you are on a park bench in Lincoln Park. It's a beautiful day, and you just both sat down there. You don't know each other, and do whatever you'd really do. Two of you are in an airport, and two of you are in a restaurant, whatever. And every scene is good every time. They never, ever, ever do a bad scene, ever, ever. 100% of the time, all
the scenes are good. Why do you think that is? Because you've done it. I'm sure you've analyzed it.
Because they don't need to think about – they're doing what they need to do, which is don't think about what's happened in the scene up to that point. Don't think about where the scene can go. It's ridiculous. You don't know where it's going to go. Just play your moment, and then play the next moment. And they play – like this interview. I'm not thinking about anything that I said up to this point now, and I'm not thinking what I'm going to say. I'm just paying attention to what you're asking me, and I'm talking, and you're doing the same thing. You're listening to me. That's a good scene. Well, when you have to worry about object work, you don't have to worry about a character, you don't have to worry about anything, getting laughs, entertaining, nothing. It's just like, I just need to listen to them and be honest and reply. It always works, because as humans, we naturally want to entertain each other anyway. I want you to like me in this interview. You want me to like you. When I'm talking to somebody, we all want to be liked all the time. So we're going to be on our best behavior, and eventually we're going to make people smile and laugh. So the laughs will always come. Now give me moments of pathos as well, and oh, we got all of life now on stage.
It's funny that would free them up, isn't it? That you have them go on stage, play themselves how they would react. You're giving them just very simple parameters. They can't leave.
Right.
They're strangers.
Right.
And they would react how they would normally
right.
react.
And if they sit there in silence for the longest time, I'll let them sit 30 seconds in silence, you know. Then I'll get up and I'll say, I know you normally wouldn't say anything in this situation, but just for the – I'll side coach them. But just for this little second of a moment, just initiate something. And then if you don't want to say anything after that, don't. And then they'll say something, boom, the dam breaks, and they start talking.
But isn't that interesting? It's so simple, yet it opens them up.
Well, I do it right away. No matter what level I have, I do it the first class, so they have a bench line of, okay, this is I know what that's like. This is easy to do. This is what that feels like. Now I simply have to translate it to my characters and scenes. So I'd rather have – so if they're doing a whole scene talking about what their favorite potato is and why they like potatoes or don't like potatoes or whatever, because that's where the conversation came up in the scene in the park bench, I always say, okay, so if you got the suggestion of pirates from the audience and this is the exact scene I saw, I would love it. because I'm seeing two pirates talking about what kind of potatoes they like. I'd rather see that than, "Arr, matey, where's me treasure? Oh, it's right here where my parrot says it is. Well, let me get me map." Fuck you and all the things you know about pirates. I don't care about that. I don't care about the list of things you know. I just want to see two pirates. Why do we love Breaking Bad so much? Because we saw a science teacher who was the best meth cook in the world. And we saw the reality of it. Why did we like Sopranos? Because we saw a mob boss and how it is in real life for his family. I can go down a list. And the things we like the best is because it's true.
Seinfeld, why do we like that the best?
Because these four characters, as nutty and disparate as they were all honest for who they were. And, I mean, that was the funny in-joke that was true. The show's about nothing because all they did was do what... They did what these people would do in real life. If these people were real people in real life, that's what they would do. The only difference between what we do in that real scene at the top of the class and what we do in our shows is we have that little part in our brain that says, but we are entertaining an audience. So we have to use little tricks, little tweaks to entertain the audience. Like, I've sat here in silence for 20 seconds. I can't do this for the whole scene, so I'm going to say something now. And that's the thing.
But that's the craft of improv.
Yeah, the craft of acting. You know, I do, if they give me the, but it's not funny, I do this with them a lot. I usually can tell in the first class who my jokesters are in class, who they like really rely on the jokes. And I'll go, okay, come on up here. I want to do something with you. You're a very funny guy, you know, right? Yeah, very funny guy. And you get laughs in shows and everything, right? Yeah, you get laughs in shows and everything. You like that, right? Yeah, I like that. Okay. I get the clock out. I get the stopwatch. 7 seconds. Say something funny. I did. That wasn't funny. All right. I'm giving you now. You know what's coming. I'll give it again. Give me 7 seconds. Something funny. Boom. Nope. That's not funny at all. All right. One more time. 7 seconds. Give me something truthful and honest. Boom. Every time. I love peas. You know, I grew up in Chicago. Whatever. Which one's easier? They get it.
And I bet you, when you let them take the honest, they actually get laughs.
Sometimes.
You know.
Sometimes. Yeah.
We got to wrap this up, but I have two more questions. One is, you know, you talked about things that, you know, since you've been meditating, and you're getting older, 60, or are you 60 or 61 in your head?
In my head, I'm 61.
Okay, great. But you're still 60, yeah. Correct? And there were things you wanted to do. What's left for you to do?
In life?
Yeah. It sounded like you made a list, or in your head you're like, okay, I wanted to do this. I wanted to get a tattoo. You know, is there some things left? Like, oh, you really like to be in a play at the Steppenwolf Theater?
No, those kind of goals are gone. Those kind of, I want to get an Academy Award, I want to get an Emmy, I want to get a Jeff, I want to get a whatever.
Does that come through meditation? Because meditation, if it comes through medication, I'll do it too. But if it comes through meditation, I'll up my meditation.
I've been much more at peace with the things I know that I probably won't get. You know, I beat myself up a lot less about it, and I'm a lot more just very comfortable with where I am and taking it as it comes. I really don't have any bucket list I don't have any bucket list. You know, I have things like, God, I'd love to do more shows with Susan Messing, but that's not going to happen. You know, I'd like to.
Why wouldn't that happen? Why couldn't you call Susan up and say, hey, you know what?
Because I called her twice, and both times she said, yeah, sure, you could do it. And I feel like I can't keep calling and asking, you know, and she's not going to call me because she's got so many other people that she knows way better than me. I'm just an acquaintance, you know. So, you know, and I would feel it would be wrong to, like, push it the third time.
We ask this to all our guests. What one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
A single sentence?
It's a single sentence, or it could be five paragraphs. It's whatever you'd like.
An advice to an improviser starting out today.
One piece of advice.
To what? To get them to be a better improviser? To
whatever it means to you.
Wow. I don't know.
All right, I'm going to throw this at you.
Yeah, I don't know.
What's
Jay.
One piece of advice when you look back when you started? What's one piece of advice that you would have given yourself that you know now?
If I could go back in time.
If you go back, this is a time machine. So I'm not into science fiction or any of that, but I'm creating a time machine. There's a time machine, and it takes you all the way back. And here's this 27-year-old guy who's kind of lost. He's now taking improv classes. He's a natural. What's one piece of advice that the 60-year-old Mark goes back and says to the 27-year-old Mark, here's one piece of advice I'd like to give you?
Okay. And I don't want this to sound self-serving, but all this stuff that we've been talking about philosophically and you know, analytically about improv and acting and how to do it well and, you know, and I wish I could have gone back in time and given, starting out, Mark, the teachers to give him that. Because I, from the different teachers I had, I got little bits and threads and this's and that's of it, but the way that we're talking about it, no one ever put it in that kind of perspective where it's like, oh, now I understand this. You know, it took me a lifetime of doing it to realize how to share it back with everyone, you know? I was just a natural, but I really, and I'm not blaming the teachers that I had at the time. It's just, I'm not shilling, but can I mention Truth in Comedy? I think that book is a Bible for improv students. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it name drops and I know it goes on about the Herald, but if you get rid of that, it kind of, everything that we've talked about, it's in there. It's why don't we ask questions? Why don't we worry about getting laughs? Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? The book has paragraphs and chapters about all of that stuff. I wish I would have just had that book when I started out, you know? I tell my students, I say, if you really love this improv thing and you want to be good at it for the rest of your lives, A, you're never going to make money at it. So get that out of your head. But you can do it forever and you can have the big, it's the crack cocaine of performing. There's nothing better. So here's what you got to do. Keep taking classes. Keep working. Always realize I have to learn forever. I'm going to get better because I'm going to naturally keep getting better as I do something that I love. See as much improv as you can, good and bad. Read as much about acting and improv as you can, and let yourself go back to that time in your life when the flame was so pretty that you just hugged it. And yeah, you burned yourself, and that was one of those first times you said, fuck you, I don't trust things. Well, get before that time. Get to that moment right when you're ready to grab that flame and keep that with you always.
Mark Chosky, did I get the name right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so proud of myself. Thank you so much for being our guest on this episode of Improv Nerd.
Thanks for having me. It was enjoyable to be able to talk about myself and not have that little voice in my head say, you're talking too much about yourself.
You know, before we started, you said you were afraid and you said you always get afraid. Yeah. So how did you get over the fear of doing this interview or when you do a show?
I was thinking about that. I don't know. I just relaxed into it. Rarely when I perform improv, if ever, am I nervous. I'm in performance up, you know, but I'm not in internal anxious. I'm as calm now as I would be with the microphone off and we were just sitting outside talking. Same thing when I'm doing an improv show. I'm geeked up performance-wise because I know I have to get that performance energy, but my internal is not anxious at all.
But you said something to me that was interesting because I struggle with this too. You go, oh, I'm really afraid.
Yeah.
You know, and does that help to admit to someone backstage to afraid?
Oh, God.
How does it help?
Because the fear, the nerves in performing and doing anything that's worth doing, you know, is you're going to have nerves. I'm a sports guy. I love sports, you know. And in the playoffs, when the Cubs were in the World Series, seventh game, like 10th inning or whatever, they were Anthony Rizzo and David Ross were mic'd. And Rizzo said something to the effect of, I'm so fucking nervous, you know. And Ross said, yeah, don't get any easier. So, you know, and this is Anthony Rizzo, all-star in the World Series Game 7. And he said, I'm fucking nervous. Michael Jordan was nervous every game. You know, every practice he was nervous. It's just part of it. You gotta live with it and instead of fighting it, just realize the nerves, the fear, the anxiety is all part of it. Just use it. Use it.
What do you say to people that go, I never get scared before I do a show?
I say, okay. Well, all right, good for you.
Thanks again, Mark, for being our guest.
Thanks.
Oh, my God. There you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd. Did Mark not deliver? I mean, he is so articulate about improv. And so, this is years and years and years. You can tell he just spends a lot of time on figuring stuff out. And just, I loved it. And I hope you loved it as much as I did. I want to thank the Second City Training Center in Chicago for providing us space, Jesse Swanson, for setting that up. I really appreciate that. Also, I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, workshops, and intensives called The Art of Slow Comedy, go to my webpage, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. You can also sign up for my newsletter and blog. Each week, I will send a blog that will make you a better improviser. Follow us on everything in social media. Go to Facebook, if you still go to Facebook, and like us. On the Improv Nerd page, it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and then our YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, subscribe. Also, please, if you can, help us out on our Patreon campaign. That's Patreon/Improv Nerd, I believe. Also, I want to thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run. He's a nerd.